4. Conversion. Independence is my happiness, and I view things as they are, without regard to place or person. My country is the world, and my religion is to do good. Thomas Paine, The Rights of Man. Ronnie Casserolls, white, middle class, and Jewish, was working as a 22-year-old scriptwriter for a South African film company called Alpha Film Studios in March 1960 when the Sharpeville massacre took place. 69 unarmed blacks, who had been protesting the apartheid regime's restrictive pass laws, were gunned down by white South African police, with 180 seriously wounded. Many were shot in the back as they fled. He approached some black workers at the studio to commiserate. They told him, "This is South Africa. Amapoisa isinya. The police are dogs." Groups of white English and Afrikaans were also gathering in separate groups. The massacre, everyone knew, signaled the start of a new phase in blacks' battle for liberation in apartheid South Africa. One of the white men told Casserolls, "Mooney, don't worry, mate. You'll be in the trenches with the rest of us. Ons vitos, us white guys, have to sink or swim together." But his white co-workers were wrong. Something snapped in Casserolls. He underwent a conversion, the rite of passage of all revolutionaries. During the next few days, he argued passionately with family and friends about the gross injustice that had taken place, but found that outside my immediate circle, few whites showed any sensitivity, the general view being, we should machine gun the lot of them. He watched enraged blacks burn their passbooks in defiance and get arrested. The apartheid government declared a state of emergency. It outlawed the African National Congress, ANC, and its rival, the Pan-African Congress, PAC. British-made Saracen-armored cars with their mounted 30-caliber machine guns rumbled down the streets of the Alexandra Township, where most of the black workers at the film studio lived. Casserolls was no longer able to be a passive accomplice in a system of such gross injustice. He took time off from his job and went to Durban, where he met Rolly Arenstein, a radical lawyer who was being hunted by the police. Arenstein urged Casserolls to join what he called the movement, predicting that the ruling National Party government would not last 6 more months in power, a prediction that was off by 3 decades. Casserolls became Arenstein's driver. He chauffeured the lawyer to various safe houses around Durban. He met others also being hunted by the police. Casserolls returned to his job, but at night he drafted and printed leaflets for the underground movement, calling for the release of all detainees, the lifting of the state of emergency, and a democratic government for blacks and whites. He painted anti-apartheid slogans on walls at night. He eventually committed himself totally to the struggle. Turning his back on his job, his class, his government, and his race, Casserolls joined the South African Communist Party and the African National Congress. He became a founding member, along with Nelson Mandela, of Umkhonto Isizwe, MK, or Spear of the Nation, the armed wing of the ANC. Casserolls became a rebel. Such a decision to engage in open defiance, abandoning all that is safe, familiar, and secure for a precarious life of resistance, is often triggered by a singular traumatic experience. Lenin was radicalized when his older brother, Alexander Ilyich Ulyanov, was executed after being involved in a plot to assassinate the Tsar, and he began to read his dead brother's radical books. The trip taken by the 22-year-old medical student Ernesto Che Guevara, like Casserolls and Lenin, a member of the middle class, into the poor backwaters of South America, allowed him to place himself in the shoes of the oppressed. Such conversions have more to do with the heart than the head. Empathy is the most important asset. Guevara, like Casserolls and Lenin, would use his empathy to justify violence, a dangerous transformation when all action, even murder, becomes acceptable in the name of the coming utopia. But the sentiments engendered at the moment of conversion are real. Albert Camus said that no rebellion can take place without this strange form of love. When I met with Casserolls in New York, he spoke of an incident in 1984 involving a South African death squad led by the notorious killer and former police colonel Eugène de Kock. De Kock was the commanding officer of C-1, a counterinsurgency unit of the South African police that in the 1980s and 1990s kidnapped, tortured, and murdered hundreds of anti-apartheid activists and ANC leaders. He and his hit squad had recently assassinated three of Kasrul's ANC comrades. Kasrul's tracked De Kock, nicknamed Prime Evil, and now serving a life sentence in South Africa, and his squad of killers to a motel in Swaziland. Kasrul's organized a group of ANC insurgents to gun down the members of the hit squad. De Kock and his men had left, however, before Kasrul's and his armed group burst into the room where they had been. I asked Kasrul's whether, should the situation be repeated today, he would organize an armed group to kill De Kock and his henchmen. I see this as similar to the French resistance and the resistance in Europe against the Nazis, he said. So you know there were the battles in the open, but most of the battles were by stealth. I don't think there's anything morally wrong in the battle of stealth against power when you are engaged in a war. They had killed, murdered in cold blood, three of our people in Swaziland. You've got to take harsh decisions at times, and this is in the context of an ongoing war there. I put it within the context of a revolutionary war. Nevertheless, he said that, when I look back, and I meet some of these people who we fought before, and I hear from them how they knew someone who died, I wish that that person didn't have to die. Kasrul served as the commander of the Natal Regional Command, and in 1964 underwent military training in Odessa in the Soviet Union. As a leader in the MK, Kasrul's carried out sabotage and bombings of state infrastructure and industrial sites. The attacks took an inevitable toll on unarmed white civilians. A 1983 MK guerrilla attack left 19 dead. A 1986 raid killed three and injured 73. Kasrul's was unrepentant. Blacks, he pointed out, paid a far higher price. Tens of thousands were slaughtered by the apartheid state. Kasrul's, a stocky bull of a man, argued that all rebels are driven by an instinctive compassion, concern for others, and a tendency toward standing up for the underdog. These impulses are often present in children, he said, but they are muted or crushed by the institutions of social control, including the family and school. Kasrul's, although an atheist, said he saw the rebel in Jesus Christ, as well as in the thunderous denunciations of evil and oppression by the Hebrew prophets of the Bible. He said that those who endure oppression, such as Mandela, and rise up to resist are better described as revolutionaries. The rebel, he said, is one who often enjoys certain liberties, but who is prepared to give up his class or her class or tribe. Rebels, he said, turn their back on their own. Kasrul spoke about a discussion he had on the nature of the rebel with Jack Simons, a retired university professor who was teaching ANC recruits in Angola and who had been a leader in the South African Communist Party before it was outlawed in 1950. Unconventional thought is a force for development, Simons told Kasrul. It is wrong to suppress it. The likes of you and I were thrown to the lions in Roman times and burnt at the stake in the Middle Ages as heretics. It was in the post-apartheid South Africa that Kasrul's fully realized Simon's wisdom. Kasrul's relentless quest for political and economic justice eventually turned him into a fierce critic of the two organizations to which he had dedicated himself for 50 years, the African National Congress and the Communist Party. The failure of these two organizations to ameliorate the suffering of the poor, the rampant corruption that he said exists within the leadership of the ANC, and the Marikana massacre of 2012, in which 34 striking miners were gunned down by the South African Police Service, the country's most lethal single assault on unarmed civilians since the 1960 Sharpeville massacre, left him alienated once again from the centers of power. Camus observed that every revolutionary who achieves power ends by becoming either an oppressor or a heretic. I have to speak up, Kasrul said. It's deep within me. Kasrul said that the ANC's fatal mistake, which he concedes was partly his fault, was its decision during the transition to power in 1994 to shelve its socialist economic agenda, known as the Freedom Charter. Written in 1955, the charter had wide popular appeal. It demanded the end of the exploitation by the white oligarchic elite, who treated black laborers as serfs on farms, in mines, and on factory floors. It called for the right to work, freedom of expression, access to decent housing and land for all South Africans, and the sharing of South African wealth, especially its mineral resources. Banks, industries, and mines were to be nationalized. Castrels and other ANC leaders believed that they could deal with economic injustice later. They were fearful of defying Western imperialism and, as Castrels put it, neoliberal global economy market fundamentals. But the ANC's capitulation to global pressure to adopt a free market economy has proved to be a disaster. South Africa continues to be one of the most unequal societies on the planet. Whites, although they number less than 10% of the nation's population, earn 7.7 times more on average than their black counterparts. Only a few thousand of the country's 41 million blacks earn more than $5,000 a year. It is apartheid by another name. A true rebel would not have accepted that, Castrel said. The goal of the counter-revolutionary is to physically eradicate the insurgents' logistical base of operations, disrupt their communication, and shatter their organization. Counter-revolutionaries seek to dry up popular, financial, and material support for the revolutionaries. They hunt down and decapitate leaders. Counter-revolutionaries create rival organizations to discredit and purge the rebel leadership and infiltrate the movement to foster internal divisions and rivalries. They provoke the movement by forming front groups that carry out repugnant acts to alienate the wider populace from the insurgency. Meanwhile, the counter-revolutionaries churn out shadowy propaganda that the mainstream press often runs uncritically. Finally, they offer a political alternative that appears reformist, but is ultimately under the control of the state. The tools to break resistance are similar whether those movements are violent or nonviolent. The physical eradication of the Occupy encampments, the attempt to marginalize the protesters from the wider society, the use of figures such as Anthony Capel Van Jones to co-opt the language of the Occupy movement and funnel energy into a dysfunctional electoral process, all these strategies fit the classic outline of a counter-revolutionary agenda. Counterinsurgency campaigns, although they involve arms and weapons, are primarily, as in the old cliché, about hearts and minds. The goal is to win back, or at least render passive, a disaffected population. And the tactics employed by our intelligence operatives abroad are not dissimilar from those employed by our intelligence operatives at home. In fact, these operatives are frequently the same people. But once violence is added to the mix, whether to defend the state or destroy it, something poisonous and insidious takes place. Violence is directed against society, not to convert, but to eradicate. All aspects of civic life are targeted: political, religious, educational, familial, economic, and traditional. The goal, as we see in Iraq and Afghanistan, is not to control territory, but to control populations. Terror, assassination, imprisonment, and death become the glue that replaces the tissue of social cohesion. Society is mutilated, civic life is destroyed, and in wartime, each side uses violence to attempt to shape civil society to its own ends. We do not have the tools or the wealth of the state. We cannot beat it at its own game. We cannot ferret out infiltrators. The legal system is almost always on the state side. If we attempt to replicate the elaborate security apparatus of our oppressors, even on a small scale, we unleash paranoia and fracture those who build movements. If we retreat into anonymity, hiding behind masks, then we provide an opening for agents provocateurs who deny their identities while disrupting the movement. If we fight pitched battles in the streets, we give authorities an excuse to fire their weapons and demonize the movement to the public. All we have, as Václav Havel wrote, is our powerlessness, and that powerlessness is our strength. The ability of the movement to overthrow the corporate state depends on embracing this powerlessness. It depends on two of our most important assets, utter and complete transparency, and a rigid adherence to nonviolence, including respect for private property. These assets permit us, as Havel puts it in his classic 1978 essay, The Power of the Powerless, to live in truth. And by living in truth, we expose a corrupt corporate state that perpetrates lies and functions by deceit. Havel, who would become the first president of the Czech Republic in 1993, reflects in the essay on the mind of a greengrocer who, as instructed, puts up a poster among the onions and carrots that reads, "Workers of the World, Unite." He displays the poster partly out of habit, partly because everyone else is doing it, and partly out of fear of the consequences for not following the rules. Havel notes that the greengrocer would not display a poster saying, "I am afraid," and therefore unquestioningly obedient. This, for Havel, was the difference between the terror of a Joseph Stalin or an Adolf Hitler and the collective charade between the rulers and the ruled that by the 1970s had gripped communist Czechoslovakia. Imagine that one day something in our greengrocer snaps, and he stops putting up the slogans merely to ingratiate himself, Havel writes. He stops voting in elections he knows are a farce. He begins to say what he really thinks at political meetings. And he even finds the strength in himself to express solidarity with those whom his conscience commands him to support. In this revolt, the greengrocer steps out of living within the lie. He rejects the ritual and breaks the rules of the game. He discovers once more his suppressed identity and dignity. He gives his freedom a concrete significance. His revolt is an attempt to live within the truth. This attempt to live within the truth brings with it ostracism and retribution. Punishment, Havel points out, is imposed in bankrupt systems because of the necessity for compliance, not out of any genuine conviction. And the real crime committed is not the crime of speaking out or defying the rules, but the crime of exposing the charade. By breaking the rules of the game, he has disrupted the game as such. He has exposed it as a mere game, Havel says of his greengrocer. He has shattered the world of appearances, the fundamental pillar of the system. He has upset the power structure by tearing apart what it holds together. He has demonstrated that living a lie is living a lie. He has broken through the exalted facade of the system and exposed the real base foundations of power. He has said that the emperor is naked. And because the emperor is in fact naked, something extremely dangerous has happened. By his action, the greengrocer has addressed the world. He has enabled everyone to peer behind the curtain. He has shown everyone that it is possible to live within the truth. Living within the lie can constitute the system only if it is universal. The principle must embrace and permeate everything. There are no terms whatsoever on which it can coexist with living within the truth, and therefore, everyone who steps out of line denies it in principle and threatens it in its entirety. Those who do not carve out spaces separate from the state and its systems of power, those who cannot find room to become autonomous, or who do not live in truth, inevitably become compromised. Kasserls understood this during the Sharpeville massacre. By refusing to act, he was part of the system of oppression. Movements that call on followers to live in truth do not always succeed. They failed in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala in the 1970s and 1980s, as well as in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, triggering armed insurgencies and blood-drenched civil wars. They have failed so far in Iran, the Israeli-occupied territories, and Syria. China has a movement modeled after Havel's Charter 77, which was formed in 1977, to pressure the Czech government to abide by human rights guarantees enshrined in the Constitution and honor international human rights accords that the communist government had signed, called Charter 08. But the Chinese opposition to the state has been effectively suppressed, even though its principal author, Liu Xiaobo, currently serving an 11-year prison term for incitement of subversion of state power, was awarded the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize. Power elites, who stubbornly refuse to heed popular will and resort to harsher and harsher forms of state control, provoke counterviolence. The first Palestinian uprising, which lasted from 1987 to 1992, saw crowds of demonstrators throw rocks at Israeli soldiers, but it was largely a non-violent movement. The second uprising, or Intifada, which erupted in 2000 and endured for 5 years, included armed attacks on Israeli soldiers and civilians. And the clashes during the summer of 2014 saw Hamas launching rockets into Israel from Gaza and carrying out armed assaults in Israeli territory via tunnels it had constructed. History is dotted with brutal fratricides spawned by calcified and repressive regimes that ignored the legitimate grievances of their citizens and continued to visit injustices upon them, or in the case of Israel, upon the people it occupies and whose peaceful protests it crushes. A resistance movement's most powerful asset, however, is that it articulates a fundamental truth. As this truth is understood by the mainstream, the 99%, it gathers a force that jeopardizes the credibility of ruling elites. If the resistance movement is effectively severed from the mainstream, which is the primary goal of the counterinsurgency effort by the Department of Homeland Security, city police departments, and the FBI, it is crippled and easily contained. Other, more militant groups may rise and even flourish. But if a mass movement is to retain its hold over the majority, it has to fight within self-imposed limitations of nonviolence. We would not have a movement if violence or property damage were used from the outset, Kevin Zeese, one of the first activists to call for an Occupy movement, told me. People are not drawn to violent movements. Such tactics will shrink rather than expand our base of support. Property damage justifies police violence to many Americans. There is a wide range of diversity of tactics within a nonviolent strategy. Disciplined nonviolence is often more difficult because anger and emotion lead people to want to strike back at the police when they are violent, but disciplined nonviolence is the tactic that is most effective against the violence of the state. The organizer, Lisa Fithian, is one of the authors of A Concise Argument for Nonviolence, an open letter to the Occupy movement. The essay points out that without agreements that enshrine nonviolence, the young are privileged over the old, the loud voices over the soft, the fast over the slow, the able-bodied over those with disabilities, the citizen over the immigrant, white folks over people of color, those who can do damage and flee the scene over those who are left to face the consequences. Of the slogan used by the Black Bloc anarchists, Fithian and her co-authors write, "Diversity of tactics becomes an easy way to avoid wrestling with questions of strategy and accountability. It lets us off the hook from doing the hard work of debating our positions and coming to agreements about how we want to act together. It becomes a code for anything goes and makes it impossible for our movements to hold anyone accountable for their actions. The Occupy movement includes people from a broad diversity of backgrounds, life experiences, and political philosophies," the article goes on. "Some of us want to reform the system, and some of us want to tear it down and replace it with something better. Our one great point of agreement is our call for transparency and accountability. We stand against the corrupt institutions that broker power behind closed doors. We call to account the financial manipulators that have built billions out of the poor and the middle classes. Just as we call for accountability and transparency, we ourselves must be accountable and transparent," the authors write. "Some tactics are incompatible with those goals, even if in other situations they might be useful, honorable, or appropriate. We can't be transparent behind masks. We can't be accountable for actions we run away from. We can't maintain the security culture necessary for planning and carrying out attacks on property, and also maintain the openness that can continue to invite in a true diversity of new people. We can't make alliances with groups from impacted communities, such as immigrants, if we can't make agreements about what tactics we will employ in any given action. By the 1980s, Mandela and the ANC leadership had recognized that as the struggle against apartheid evolved, it was the strikes and boycotts, along with the organizing work by nonviolent groups such as the United Democratic Front, UDF, the ANC's political wing, that were the best instruments for crippling the apartheid regime. The ANC's tiny rebel bands were increasingly ineffectual. South Africa heavily patrolled its borders and stymied most cross-border infiltrations and attacks. Armed attacks frightened white liberals, who were natural allies in the anti-apartheid movement and were used by the apartheid regime to justify state violence. It was the growing use of non-cooperation by the black majority that brought the economic engines of the country to a halt. The tactic of nonviolent protest also garnered support from the international community, which eventually imposed sanctions. If the ANC had invested all its energy in an armed movement rather than mass mobilization, it would have never triumphed. Mandela, although he never renounced violence, understood by this time that the movement had become a civil insurrection rather than an armed insurrection. And it was this transformation and his ability as a leader to recognize and respect the transformation that allowed the movement to triumph. Mandela was open about the inner moral struggle that accompanied his foray into violence and then his retreat from violence. In an excerpt from a 1979 letter to his former wife Winnie, included in his last book, Conversations with Myself, he wrote, "Habits die hard, and they leave their unmistakable marks. The invisible scars that are engraved in our bones and that flow in our blood, that do havoc to the principal actors beyond repair. Such scars portray people as they are and bring out into the full glare of public scrutiny the embarrassing contradictions in which individuals live out their lives. We are told that a saint is a sinner who keeps on trying to be clean. One may be a villain for 3/4 of his life and be canonized because he lived a holy life for the remaining quarter of that life. In real life, we deal not with gods, but with ordinary humans like ourselves, men and women who are full of contradictions, who are stable and fickle, strong and weak, famous and infamous, people in whose bloodstream the muckworm battles daily with potent pesticides. As societies unravel, as desperation becomes worldwide, it may happen that neither nonviolence nor violence will do very much to alter our impending self-destruction. Violence, in moments when we face near certain annihilation, can become a final affirmation of human dignity. But by then, the game is over." Hannah Krall's book, Shielding the Flame, drew on the experience of Dr. Marek Edelman, who before he died in 2009 was the sole survivor of the 5-person command that led the April 1943 Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Edelman was 23 years old when he helped lead the uprising, refused to hold up his actions as more moral than the actions of those who walked with their children to the gas chambers. After all, he said, by the time of the uprising, he and the other resistance fighters knew that death was, for most of them, inevitable. In the apocalypse of the Warsaw Ghetto, armed resistance was morally justified, as even Edelman pointed out, but it was not the only choice. The uprising, started by mostly young Jews, lasted 3 weeks. They formed the Zadovska Organizatsiya Boyova, ZOB, or Jewish Fighting Combat Organization. The uprising ended when the Germans burned and razed the ghetto. Edelman escaped through the sewers and was carried away from the ghetto on a stretcher by members of the underground posing as members of the Polish Red Cross. A sign reading typhus was placed on his body. German soldiers' fear of contracting typhus ensured his easy passage through checkpoints. One of the women carrying the stretcher, Alina Margolis, later became Edelman's wife. In the 1980s, during part of the war in El Salvador, Margolis, a pediatrician, lived in my house in San Salvador. She was working in a refugee camp for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. She and Edelman were socialists. They did not support the Zionist leadership's decision during World War II to negotiate with the Nazis so Jews could leave Europe for Palestine. Edelman and Margolis were committed to building societies where Jews could remain in Europe. They sought to foster a solidarity and common cause with all anti-Nazi forces, rather than retreating into the exclusive Zionist call for a Jewish state. They believed that capitalism was the problem. Edelman and Margolis, horrified by the slaughter and mass displacement of Palestinians when Israel was created in 1948, denounced Israel's occupation. They defended the right of Palestinian people to resist that occupation, even through violence. They saw in the Palestinian struggle their own fight against German occupation during the war. Poland's Jewish population of 3 million was largely obliterated in mass executions and concentration camps. This population comprised half of all the Jews murdered in the Nazi Holocaust. But Edelman, who witnessed 2/3 of the Warsaw ghetto population being taken away without resistance in cattle cars to the extermination camps, had little time for those who criticized these families for walking meekly to slaughter. He saw how starvation had broken the will of those around him. He saved his venom for those on the Jewish councils and the Jewish police, who knew about the mass exterminations and nevertheless did the Nazis' bidding and herded their fellow Jews into the cattle cars. Starvation drove thousands of families into the hands of the Nazis, who passed out oblong brown loaves of rye bread to those who boarded the trains that took them unknowingly to the Nazi death camp Treblinka. Death in moments of extremity was about retaining one's dignity. To die in a gas chamber is by no means worse than to die in battle. The only undignified death is when one attempts to survive at the expense of somebody else, Edelman told Kroll. Being deported was infinitely more difficult than to go out shooting. After all, it is much easier to die firing. For us, it was much easier to die than it was for someone who first boarded a train car, then rode the train, then dug a hole, then undressed naked. To be totally alone, even for those who faced certain death, was to be drained of purpose and meaning. There was a ferocious struggle to cling to life. One would secrete oneself somewhere with the other person, in a bed, in a basement, anywhere, and until the next action, one was not alone anymore. One person had had his mother taken away, somebody else's father had been shot and killed, or a sister taken away in a shipment. So if someone, somehow, by some miracle escaped and was still alive, he had to stick to some other living human being. People were drawn to one another as never before, as never in normal life. During the last liquidation action, they would run to the Jewish council in search of a rabbi or anybody who could marry them. And then they would go to the Umschlagplatz, where Jews were forced to gather for transportation to the death camps as a married couple. He described a friend he called Adam, who had graduated before the war from military college and who took part in the September 1939 fight against the German forces that invaded Poland. He was famous for his courage, Edelman told Kroll. For many years, he was a real idol of mine. One day, the two men were walking down Lesno Street in the ghetto, and all of a sudden, some SS men started shooting. He went on, the crowd scrambled away desperately, and so did he. You know, I had never before suspected that he could be afraid of anything, and there he was, my idol, running away. Because he was used to always having a weapon by his side. In the military college, later in the defense of Warsaw in September, and in Modlin. The others had weapons, but he had a weapon too, so therefore he could be brave. But when it happened that the others were firing their arms and he couldn't shoot, he became another man. It all actually happened without a single word, from one day to the next. He simply quit all activity. And when the first meeting of the command group was about to be held, he was useless for participating in it. So I went instead. He had a girlfriend, Anya. One day they took her to Pavyak prison. She managed to get out later. But the day they took her, he broke down completely. He came to see us, leaned his hands on the table, and started telling us that we were all lost, that they would slaughter us all, and that since we were young, we should escape to the forest and join the partisans instead of attempting to form an underground here in the city. Nobody interrupted him. After he'd left, somebody said, "It's because they have taken her away." He has no reason to live anymore. Now he will get killed. The tragedy of the ghetto, of violence and counter-violence, extended to the hated Jewish police, who collaborated with the Nazis to maintain control and hunt down the underground resistance. The underground assassinated Jakob Laken, a senior Jewish police officer who zealously helped the Nazis organize the deportations in October 1942. But even Laken had a story. He had a child, born after 17 years of marriage, and he hoped by joining the police to save the child's life. Edelman noted the collective self-delusion that prohibited the Jews in the ghetto, as it prohibits us, from facing their fate, even after it became clear that the transports were taking thousands daily to Treblinka. In 1942, the underground resistance sent a spy to follow the trains. He returned to the ghetto and reported that freight trains loaded with people entered Treblinka and returned empty. He noted that food supplies were never sent to the death camp. The spy's account was written up in the underground ghetto newspaper, but as Edelman remarked, nobody believed it. "Have you gone insane?" people would say when we were trying to convince them that they were not being taken to work, Edelman remembered. "Would they be sending us to death with bread? So much bread would be wasted." Edelman condemned Adam Chernyakov, the Jewish leader of the ghetto, for committing suicide by swallowing cyanide on July 23, 1942, the day after the mass deportation of the Jews to Treblinka began. Chernyakov, Edelman said, should have informed everyone in the ghetto of the deportations. He should have dissolved all public institutions, especially the Jewish police. They would have believed him, Edelman said. But he had committed suicide. That wasn't right. One should die with a bang. At that time, this bang was most needed. One should die only after having called other people into the struggle. Edelman went on to say that Chernyakov's suicide was the only thing we reproach him for. "We?" Kral asked. "Me and my friends," Edelman said. "The dead ones. We reproach him for having made his death his own private business. We were convinced that it was necessary to die publicly, under the world's eyes." Traditional concepts of right and wrong, Edelman pointed out, collapse in moments of extremity. Edelman spoke to Kral about a doctor in the ghetto hospital who poisoned the sick children on her ward as the Germans entered the building. She saved children from the gas chamber. She became, to those who remained in the ghetto, a hero. So what, then, in that world turned upside down, was heroism, Kral asked, or honor, or dignity? And where was God? God, Edelman said, was on the side of the persecutors, a malicious God. Edelman said that as a heart surgeon in Poland after the war, he felt that he was always battling against this malevolent deity who sought to extinguish life. God is trying to blow out the candle, and I'm quickly trying to shield the flame, taking advantage of his brief inattention, to keep the flame flickering, even if only for a little while longer than he would wish. It is important. He is not terribly just. It can also be very satisfying, because whenever something does work out, it means you have, after all, fooled him. Edelman came upon a crowd of people on Zalazna Street in Warsaw after the occupation, but before the ghetto was established. The crowd was standing around a simple wooden barrel with a Jew on top of it. He was old and short, and he had a long beard. Edelman went on. Next to him were two German officers, two beautiful tall men next to this small bowed Jew. And those Germans, tuft by tuft, were chopping off this Jew's long beard with huge tailor shears, splitting their sides with laughter all the while. The surrounding crowd was also laughing, because objectively, it really was funny. A little man on a wooden barrel with his beard growing shorter by the moment as it disappeared under the tailor shears, just like a movie gag. At that time, the ghetto did not exist yet, and one might not have sensed the grim premonition in that scene. After all, nothing really horrible was happening to that Jew, only that it was now possible to put him on a barrel with impunity, that people were beginning to realize that such activity wouldn't be punished, and that it provoked laughter. But you know what? At that moment, I realized that the most important thing on earth was going to be never letting myself be pushed onto the top of the barrel. Never by anybody. Do you understand? Everything I was to do later, I was doing in order not to let myself get pushed up there. There will be no moral hierarchy to resistance. We will be pulled one way or another by fate and love. And these different routes of resistance will all be legitimate as long as we do not, as Edelman said, attempt to survive at the expense of somebody else. Many of those in the developing world, as climate change makes human habitation where they live difficult and then impossible, will be faced with a terrible moral quandary endured by Edelman. They will be denied the luxury of nonviolence. But if the ecosystem continues to disintegrate, we will all have to grapple with forms of resistance that, in the end, will permit us only to protect our dignity until the inevitable comes. The majority of us favored an uprising, Edelman told Krall. After all, humanity had agreed that dying with arms was more beautiful than without arms. Therefore, we followed this consensus. In the Jewish Combat Organization, there were only 220 of us left. Can you even call that an uprising? All it was about finally was that we not just let them slaughter us when our turn came. It was only a choice as to the manner of dying.